Hey, the following isn't part of our usual programming. It's something I've been struggling with for quite a while now. As I write these words, it is Eid al-Fitr 2024, almost exactly 6 months into Israel's terrible assault on Gaza. Even though I'm over 7,000 miles away, nestled safely in a Texan metropolis, I am haunted by the barbarity of what's unfolding in Palestine. I'm embarrassed to admit that it has traumatized me to some degree, ashamed of owning up to my fragility when I think of the steadfastness of those who suffer daily violence, the heroes of Gaza. But I don't intend to sit here and wax poetic about their truly ineffable plight. To be honest, I'm not sure what this is supposed to be. I'm not here to make the case for Palestine, nor argue against the Zionist rhetoric living rent-free in my head. There will be no historical analyses, appeals to reason, or sentimental pleas. All I know is that I've started and stopped writing this so many times that it has to come out, whatever shape it ends up taking. It was in November when I first felt the urge to channel some of the nervous energy that I couldn't put into activism into words instead. I set out to write a short article, which I hoped to publish online somewhere. Originally, it was supposed to be about the experience of being Arab American in that moment, and its profound sense of alienation, one that deepened with every exposure to mainstream media and every other conversation with an acquaintance, well-meaning or otherwise. I was maybe halfway done when the horror of the raid on El Shifa petrified me. The world did nothing to stop the savage destruction of a hospital complex, citing Israeli intelligence that it was, in fact, a legitimate target. At work, I overheard clients pontificate that although it resembled an assault on civilian infrastructure, the issue was too complex for such a simple characterization. Even though it was frustrating to see others dismiss what I believed was a war crime so offhandedly, my inside voice counseled patience and grace, whispering reassuring words to me. These decent, intelligent folks weren't enunciating conclusions. They were wrestling with the cognitive dissonance of reconciling the prevailing worldview with the evidence their very phones and screens presented them with. It's okay, Zaid. Ahel Gaza may be suffering, but at least their cries were finally making them visible. I was sure that the brutality of the Israeli response meant that it wouldn't be long before regular people found it impossible to ignore the injustice of Palestinian existence any longer. So I abandoned the article and sought instead to just share and discuss the daily atrocities unfolding in Gaza online. Maybe sought is the wrong word. I found the news so unspeakably horrific that simply witnessing it didn't seem enough. I was compelled to do whatever I could to help it reach the widest audience possible. The sheer vitriol I encountered eroded what precious little was left of my mental health. In comment sections and social media, every argument I came across was either disingenuous from the start or devolved into expressions of naked hatred after a couple replies. While this was no great surprise, it drained me pretty quickly, and I turned back to activism in search of a feeling of community. More signs, more protests, more messages to my congresspeople. All I reaped for these efforts were more heartbreaking videos which I couldn't turn away from. A 12-year-old child waving a white flag shot in the head, then his 14-year-old brother who came running after him. A surgeon forced to amputate his 10-year-old daughter's leg over a bucket with no anesthetic, as those around her held her down while she howled in pain. Meanwhile, media here in the States admonished protesters for using the term genocide, pedantically pointing out that it barely qualified as an ethnic cleansing. The voice inside grew a lot more cynical. "Don't act so surprised, Zaid. You've always known that it's a might makes right kind of world. Why would anyone be interested in helping the powerless Palestinians?" I'd been seeing a therapist, and they told me I was beginning to exhibit signs of depression, that I had the responsibility to shield myself from stuff I knew would harm me. I didn't understand what they were suggesting. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Oh, you know, you can read the sports page and opinion columns, but stay away from the news." We sat in silence for a few minutes. Then I got up and ended the session early. Now that I'm a few months removed from the incident, I can readily admit that their advice of stoicism in the face of events demonstrably outside of my control was quite logical. But I was scandalized at the thought that I could choose to ignore the suffering of others for the sake of my own tranquility. Although I bristled at the suggestion back then, ultimately, if you can't look away, your body does it for you. You see so much suffering that you simply can't take any more in. You become so oversaturated that you no longer feel anything. No longer able to experience the crushing survivor's guilt that comes from bearing witness to all this pain, your attention drifts back to other topics. And so, released from the grip of the tragedy of Palestine, I return to some form of business as usual. Maybe make some progress on the pod. I get to heal a little before some fresh horror emerges and the cycle starts once again. It's a loop around some dark and dispiriting psychological terrain that has sadly become all too familiar these days. It both helps and hurts that my loved ones have expressed similar trauma. Writing this brings to mind a verse from one of my favorite poems, Amam Abab Allah, or Standing Outside God's Door, by Bedr Shakir al-Sayyab. Here's an amateurish English translation. "I'm tired of this hot, withering wind, wrestling against the currents and my conscience, and of my nights among these palms, the lamp, my thoughts, chasing after rhymes, in a darkness of black seas and silent dunes, a labyrinth of doubt and madness. I'm tired of my grand struggle. I would tear a piece of my heart to feed those in need. I would light their tents with the candles of my eyes. I would clothe them with old, discarded flags. Rags reeking of defeat. I'm tired of my final spring. I see it in the pollen and the daisy and the rose. I see it as the season spreads beyond my confining borders. I'm tired of this artificial life, stuck in a past, calling my yesterday tomorrow as if I were some actor from an expired world, chased by the fates as darkness falls around him. They light candles on his grand theater, and he laughs until dawn, his heart bursting with the flames of this searing wind. I'm tired. I am tired as a child who has sobbed himself to sleep." I only restarted this write-up at my brother's insistence. He encouraged me to try again, and didn't give up on me when I failed the second time and slipped back into exhaustion. Another thing he did was forward a YouTube video to me. It was some guy sharing his recent thoughts on Palestine and how they had evolved over time. I'd been so inundated with such material that I didn't think I'd listen to it at first, but I'm glad I checked it out a few days later. Hearing him speak was like applying balm to fresh wounds, and it motivated me to go ahead with this. He makes wonderful use of poetry in that talk, far more elegantly than I, and I highly recommend it to all my listeners. I'll provide a link on our show's website, thecaliphs.com. Somewhat like Sean the YouTuber, I'm going to talk about Palestine obliquely by discussing my own experience. If you've been with me this long, then you must at least trust that I can be honest with you. I'm not here to push my opinions on anyone, just to tell you about some of the ways Israel and Palestine have cropped up in my life, a perspective I hope some of you will find useful. I should probably start by saying that I'm not Palestinian, and neither of my parents' family trees can be traced back to Palestine. I don't recall our time in Iraq, as I was only 4 years old when we left at the outbreak of the first Gulf War. We eventually resettled in Jordan, and that is where my earliest memories are from. Something like 20% of the population are descendants of Palestinians who were displaced by the Nakba in 48, a percentage that rises sharply in Jordanian cities. I didn't know it at the time, but many of the rhymes we sang on the school bus were Palestinian, hymns from a bygone past about milking cows on green pastures. Many of our childhood friends were Palestinian, and in some cases, we've been lucky enough to hold on to these relationships. It's only thanks to Al-Tabari that I remember something relevant from my time in Jordan. To be clear, I'm not referring to Muhammad ibn Jarir al-Tabari, the famed historian whose compendium guided us through our exploration of Arab history. I'm talking about my family's personal al-Tabari, our meticulous archivist, my mother. No doubt, like many other moms around the world, she held on to every scrap of paper her kids brought home from school and all the silly things we made growing up. I used to enjoy creating mock magazines. My parents worked in an office, and they'd sometimes bring home blank paper and stationery. I'd stack 5 sheets, fold them down the middle, staple along the crease, and voila, I had a blank 10-page canvas. I mostly enjoyed filling it with jokes, riddles, rhymes, and drawings, but it was conventional knowledge that every respectable magazine had to open with news. Mom and I were going through my childhood memorabilia last summer, and I was shocked to find that one of my magazines had a page with the headline, "Netanyahu says something stupid. Angry people throw rocks at him." It must have been from 95 or 96. It was a dizzying experience to be unexpectedly confronted by a reminder of how stagnant the Palestinian cause had been for literally my entire life. We moved to Lebanon in 97, and even though we were surrounded by my mom's family, it took us a while to adjust. Compared to sleepy Amman, Beirut was an intimidating tangle of identities, communities, and power lines. I remember coming home one day after a soccer game with some friends, only to be stopped by a stranger in the middle of the road handing out sweets. "They've done it! Our brothers have liberated the land!" He handed me and other passerbys some ma'mul and a flyer. I had no clue what he was talking about, but it was late May 2000, and Israel had finally pulled out of South Lebanon. It took a few years, but friends from the south began to invite us to their towns and villages. Invariably, every single time, they would point out where the Israeli checkpoints had been and where the large metallic lettering that marked the name of their town in Hebrew once stood. I made a new friend at school the next year. We called him Triple A because of his initials, but more so because we were all into WWF, now WWE, and it sounded like Triple H, a popular wrestler back then. He and I were talking one day. I don't exactly recall about what, but at some point in the conversation, he furtively whispered, "I'm Palestinian." Confused at the secrecy, I asked him about it, and he said he didn't want our classmates to know, because many Lebanese discriminate against people like him. "What? Weren't we all for the Palestinian cause?" I asked. He scanned my face, detected no sarcasm, and explained to 14-year-old Zaid that it was a little bit more complicated than that. Palestinians in Lebanon are crowded into refugee camps and barred from formal participation in the economy. While I had grown up in Jordan, one of the few places on earth where Palestinians could exist without restrictions, Triple A had grown up in Lebanon, where Palestinians were treated very differently. They still can't get work permits, can't access public hospitals, and can't enroll their kids in schools. Not without relatively hefty bribes, at least. Triple A lived in Al-Dahi, a stone's throw away from the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, infamous for the 1985 massacres, when Israeli troops facilitated, shielded, and guided Lebanese militia fighters as they slaughtered thousands of Palestinian women and children. Dahi translates as the suburb. If that brings to mind an idyllic American suburb, then perhaps I should have used the French banlieue to conjure up images of poverty, displacement, and disrepair instead. Dahi is a southern extension of Beirut, blithely referred to in Western media as a Hezbollah stronghold, because it's where the Shia population of South Lebanon set up shop when they sought to relocate closer to the capital, following the Israeli occupation of the south. You'd think that living among these implacable foes of the Zionist project would fill Triple A with a sense of camaraderie, or at least I did. The reality was unfortunately a lot grimmer. Because the Palestinian cause resonates with us Arabs, it is instrumentalized by our political parties, ideologies, and any other aspirants to public legitimacy. Despite paying lip service to the necessity of pursuing justice for the Palestinians, these institutions or politicians are ultimately only concerned with furthering their own ends. I remember one visit to the south as a teenager. A friend had invited me for a sleepover in their village, and we were chatting with their neighbors. They told us how difficult life had been under Israeli occupation and how proud they were of Hezbollah for liberating the south. Then, to end a lull in the conversation, one of them volunteered, "After Zionists, the people I hate the most are Palestinians." I had no way of processing the absurdity of this statement at the time, though I am no longer surprised by it as an adult. I wouldn't even blink if I came across a snippet in American journalism today, which quoted a far-right figure saying, "I hate terrorists more than I hate Jews." That's what Hezbollah is, a far-right military-political organization mainly interested in the Palestinian cause as a way of furthering its own legitimacy in the eyes of the Arab public. These were the sorts of people Triple A had to live around, and it is no wonder that he wanted to keep his identity under wraps. I'm torn between limiting the discussion to Palestine and letting loose with tangents such as this one on the hypocrisy of Arab politics. On one hand, I want to emerge with a consistent and focused episode. But on the other, I want my words to flow naturally, with as little editing as possible. I also struggle with the guilt of glossing over certain atrocities. I prevaricated for about an hour over that mention of Sabra and Shatila, before ultimately realizing that Palestinian suffering in Lebanon, at the hands of Lebanese, is simply too large a subject for me to broach. It's a shameful stain on Lebanon, perhaps one of many, but certainly one of the darkest. It's the same with this diatribe on the impotence of championing Palestine through the politics of other Arab countries. I could talk about that for days, but I'll suffice with another few lines of modern verse. Nizar Qabbani wrote a piece he titled Margin Notes on the Defeat After the Six-Day War. Note number 17 goes, "If someone could guarantee my safety, if I could meet the Sultan, I'd say to him, 'Sultan, sir, your savage dogs have torn my clothes. Your informants chase me constantly. Their eyes chase me. Their noses chase me, their feet chase me, like inevitable fate, like judgment. They interrogate my wife and take down the names of my friends. Esteemed Sultan, because I dared approach your deaf walls, because I tried to express my sorrow, our plight, your soldiers beat me with their shoes and forced me to eat my own. Your Majesty, esteemed Sultan, you have lost the war twice over, because half our people have no tongues with which to speak. What value is a people without a voice? Because half our people are besieged, like ants, like rats within your imposing walls. If anyone could guarantee my safety, anyone from the Sultan's camp, I would say to him, 'You have lost the war twice over, because you have departed from our shared humanity.'" July 13th, 2006, was a Thursday. It was the summer semester of my second year at college, and I had two exams I was very unprepared for that morning. They were cancelled as news spread that Israel had bombed the airport and was looking to invade the country. Hezbollah had ambushed a border patrol the day before, kidnapping two soldiers and leaving 10 others behind as casualties. Even in the midst of such alarming developments, I failed to fully grasp what was going on. I went home and made plans to go to the beach the next day, where we could clearly see the Israeli cruiser from the shore and take pictures of it on our camera phones. Others were not so lucky. One of my closest friends never got to see his home again. He went straight to his grandmother's place in Beirut, where his family congregated over the next few days before making their way to Syria to seek refuge for the duration of the conflict. Upon their return, he had to sift through the rubble of their building in Dahi to look for any surviving possessions. People were especially upset at the loss of sentimental objects, and my friend searched in vain for his many photo albums. A few months later, he bought a digital camera and began using this cool new site called Facebook to upload and store thousands of photos where they were safe from Israel's bombs. The wholesale destruction of Dahi that summer was hailed by the Israeli security establishment as a new military strategy, one that was proudly dubbed the Dahi Doctrine. The inspired Israeli general behind it later threatened, quote, "What happened in Dahi will happen in every village from which shots are fired in the direction of Israel. We will wield disproportionate power and cause immense damage and destruction. From our perspective, these are military bases." End quote. Another colonel expounded the doctrine by adding, quote, "Israel's test will be the intensity and quality of its response to incidents on the Lebanese border or terrorist attacks involving Hezbollah in the north or Hamas in the south. In such cases, Israel, again, will not be able to limit its response to actions whose severity is seemingly proportionate to an isolated incident. Rather, it will have to respond disproportionately in order to make it abundantly clear that the state of Israel will accept no attempt to disrupt the calm currently prevailing along its borders." The Geneva Convention considers collective punishment a war crime. As noted by a respected expert on human rights and international law, quote, "Under the Dahiyeh Doctrine, the civilian infrastructure of adversaries, such as Hamas or Hezbollah, are treated as permissible military targets, which is not only an overt violation of the most elementary norms of the law of war and of universal morality, but an avowal of a doctrine of violence that needs to be called by its proper name, state terrorism." End quote. But let's say you were unswayed by quibbling over laws of war and universal morality. Let's assume you're an empiricist who is only interested in observable results. The question you'd be most concerned with answering is, does it work? Does the Dahiyeh Doctrine actually deter terrorism? To answer that, we only need look to the example of the doctrine's namesake. The destruction of Dahi in 2006 left over 500,000 Lebanese homeless in an impoverished nation with an ineffective government. Aid summits were held in several countries, made generous pledges to help those impacted by the war. But the corruption endemic to the Lebanese state meant that most people did not expect the help to arrive anytime soon, if ever. But the newly unhoused people of Dahi didn't have to dread the future for too long, because mere weeks after the war, Hezbollah presented them with a proposal. Using Iranian donations, the party would facilitate the reconstruction of the entire suburb at no cost to its residents. All they had to do was sign a document authorizing a shell company to rebuild their apartment buildings. The document also stipulated that should any aid intended for the reconstruction of Dahi ever actually materialize, the company would have the right to recoup its expenses from said funds. So by 2008, Hezbollah had rebuilt Dahi in its own image, from the ground up. Far from turning the civilian population against them, the destruction of their homes and communities made its residents more reliant on Hezbollah than ever before. Even those who had no love for the party and blamed it for the war could not ignore the clear message Israel sent with its disproportionate response, that their suffering was the point. Radicalization increased on all levels. Ordinary people became more dependent on Hezbollah, and Hezbollah became more beholden to its patrons, Syria and Iran. Despite the demonstrable failure of this doctrine, it has been repeatedly employed in Gaza in the past, and being taken to a whole new level there today. I didn't meet my first Israeli until 2012. For graduation, my brother, three friends, and I arranged to go trekking in Kashmir in the summer. After arriving in the provincial capital of Srinagar, our guides told us that we would be joined by one other young man for our tour. Ben was a little taken aback when he realized that all five of his companions were from Lebanon, three specifically from the south. He was a nice, friendly guy, always clutching a prized acoustic guitar. And although we were only together for a total of 5 nights, I can recall enough for a kind of good, bad, and ugly vignette. One time, as a friend was entertaining us with some funny stories in Arabic, Ben cracked up with us at the right time, then said that even though he couldn't understand anything, our friend's tone and register was simply universally funny. Another time, he was excitedly telling us about some of the details which adorned his beloved guitar. He carried it around with him while he hiked, so it wouldn't be damaged, and occasionally he'd play for us outside the tent or by the fire. He told us that it was probably worth thousands of dollars, but that he'd only paid $150 for it. I marveled at what a good deal that was, and he said that he'd bought it off a couple Palestinians, nonchalantly adding, "You know how they are, they're all thieves. I just feel bad for whoever they stole it from." That was not a nice thing of him to say. One evening, we came across another Israeli hiker. He was traveling along a different route, but he and Ben hit it off and decided to spend the night together in his tent. The next morning, the two of them came back while we were getting ready to head our separate ways. So far, we had managed to avoid any discussion of politics. After all, we had to travel together, and none of us were looking to sour the mood on this once-in-a-lifetime vacation. Ben's new friend was, of course, unburdened by such considerations. He told us that he'd heard we were from Lebanon, that he'd love to visit. See, his dad was in Lebanon back in the 80s, and he found it beautiful. If only it wasn't for Hezbollah, the Lebanese and the Israelis could be friends. I can't say for sure that he was trolling, but when the guys reminded him that Hezbollah wasn't founded until 2 years after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and that it draws its support from the deep well of trauma that occupation had inflicted upon the people of the South, one they renewed only 6 years earlier. All he had to say in response was something in Hebrew, presumably at Ben, before walking away. I moved to the States later that year, landing in New York in October 2012. After a brief stint at the Harlem Y, I found a room I could afford for a few months on Craigslist. It was a two-bedroom apartment in Queens, and the man renting it out was a lawyer in his late 30s, who apparently did this to make a little extra money every now and again. He was friendly and inquisitive, asking me all sorts of questions about life in Lebanon and the Middle East more generally. I tried my best to answer, but it really helped me realize how little I actually knew beyond my own experience. Similar conversations with others later on are what first led me to read up on Arab history, a subject I was surprised to find so interesting. Nothing like the dry, sterile trivia we were taught at school. My host also asked me about Palestine a couple times, and even though those conversations stayed polite, they never went well. He presented me with some stridently pro-Israel arguments that I just didn't know how to respond to. Refuting them was a frustrating exercise, and I constantly failed to articulate how problematic I found them. I'm still not sure whether he actually held these views, or if he was just a lawyer who enjoyed debate. If it was the latter, then I was a poor choice of interlocutor. He didn't learn much from me, and I walked away with the impression that all Americans I discussed the topic with would be similarly insensitive to Palestinian suffering. I didn't really interact with other Americans until I moved to Texas and got a new roommate. Andrew was a few years younger than I, and he'd just moved to town for love. He wasn't just friendly to me. He was a person who genuinely sought to make a connection. It was the first time I'd had that in months, and I was fortunate to come across someone like him, He loved literature, philosophy, poetry, and music. Getting to know him was truly a pleasure, and he taught me all sorts of things, from cooking recipes to country music, and the more time I spent with him, the more at home I felt in this new country I now reside in. Even though talking to him was as natural as talking to a brother, it still took me a few weeks before I was comfortable enough to broach the topic of Israel. Looking back, I guess I was curious about his views because I trusted his moral judgment and wanted to know what impression someone like him ended up with following an American upbringing. I remember we were out getting drinks when I said I wanted to ask him about something contentious. He told me to go ahead with his usual ease, then let out a laugh when I said it was about Israel. He was amused that I was behaving so stereotypically Arab, approaching the subject warily and defensively. Andrew said he understood Israel as a consequence of World War II. He felt immense sympathy for Jewish people in light of all the suffering they had endured in Europe, and felt that Zionism was a project born out of good intentions. Like everybody else, they had a right to exist safely in a place they called home. This made perfect sense given his background. Not only was he of German descent, but he spoke fluent German and had just come back to the States following a 2-year stint as an English teacher in Leipzig. On the other hand, Andrew said he was aware of the imperialist roots of the Zionist project and wide-eyed about how such enterprises are predicated on the oppression of the populations they displace. Most worrisome of all, Israeli attitudes were only hardening, and the already immense trauma this conflict had caused seemed to stretch out with no end in sight. He found the whole history too fraught and violent to engage with intellectually for very long. He then asked me what I believed. I'd been giving the question more thought since New York. My response was that I agreed with much of what he had said, especially the part about all people having the right to exist safely in their homeland. I said the matter hinged on how one defined Zionism. What did it mean that the Jewish people felt a religious connection to this land? I said I'd be thrilled if I had a neighbor who believed the land we live on was holy, because in my mind, all that meant was that they would take care of it really well. However, if by holy they meant that my existence on this land we shared was not to be tolerated, or to use Israeli rhetoric, a demographic threat, then I would have just cause to be concerned. A spiritual Zionism could be easily accommodated in Palestine. A supremacist Zionism was itself not interested in accommodation. I told him that from my perspective, all I'd ever seen from Israel was an expansionary zeal and a callous disregard for human life. I ended by saying, although it was shameful that the U.S. was stubbornly on the wrong side of this issue, I believed that a system robust enough to end slavery would also one day disavow support of such a supremacist vision of Israel. Andrew said he'd drink to that, and that he thought any Brooklyn Jew would do the same. I think that about does it for my memoir. I've discussed Palestine with many others since then, and have also read more extensively on the topic. I recall buying Alan Dershowitz's The Case for Israel, thinking it was a sincere explanation of the Zionist position, only to be terribly disappointed. It was basically a masterclass in disingenuous argumentation, using rhetoric designed to dehumanize Palestinians and delegitimate their existence. As I read it, I recognized many of the talking points I was faced with back in Queens among its pages. While I usually donate my books to secondhand stores, this one went straight to the trash. I could give you a couple more examples of conversations I've had in the States, but they're uninformative and unsatisfying. One guy told me that the cause for Palestine was hopeless, because it was impossible for him to imagine relocating hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers from illegal settlements in the West Bank. I asked him why it was easier for him to accept the displacement of millions of Palestinians who'd lived on the land for generations. He shrugged and said he didn't know. It just was. Another guy had a wild theory about how what's wrong with Israel was that it had an Arab population that hated democracy. Their failure to do their civic duty and vote was why it kept drifting to the right. I'm just procrastinating with these examples, because now that we are done with the past, it is time to turn our attention to what's unfolding in Gaza. It's difficult to discuss or even imagine. Like staring into the sun, pondering the daily suffering of Palestinians in Gaza feels like something the human body has automatic safeguards to shield itself from. For months now, I can only expose myself to it in short 10-minute bursts that often leave me shaking with anger or indignation. It's the first thing on my mind every single day I wake up. An unbroken streak that worried me greatly last year, but that I have resigned myself to by now. I am honestly speechless. I can't find any words or concepts that adequately describe the cruelty being unleashed on Gaza. Which tragedies must I make sure to highlight? Are there any I can omit for the sake of structure? And how do I do any of this without breaking down? I can't. At least, I'm in good company. Here's an excerpt from a poem by Hala Alian, where she weaves the unspeakable into art. Despite predating the current catastrophe by over a decade, it remains tragically relevant today, perhaps more than ever. I recommend listeners check out the full clip on YouTube.
Dear Gaza, I'm sorry. Dear Beirut, I still love you like an arsonist. Dear Venice, when that glass blower put his lips to the heat and I followed his breath into an ornament, I understood grace. Dear New Orleans, you gave me swelter and melody and staircase. After the longest winter of my life, you are where I forgave myself. Dear Boston, I found the bird already dead. Crooked nest scattering the pavement, and for days, all I saw was that constellation of bones. Dear Ayanapa, I cannot hear your name without thinking war and ship and two moons before coastline. Dear Tripoli, it was whiplash. It was awful month. It was season of flinching. I won't be coming back. Dear Rome, whenever I think of my future self, she's always walking your piazza, wearing something yellow. Dear Wichita, I remember the boy band songs on the radio, the car rides through the backbone of your highway. I remember cornfields and pregnant sky and always a thunderstorm. Dear Gaza, I'm sorry. Dear Ramallah, thank you for the applause. Thank you for the seltzer water, the tabla player, the 3 a.m. tomato and bread. Thank you for the balcony. Dear Dubai, I forgot a scarf, a silver ring, a tube of lipstick, and courage to make a mistake. I found the ring, the rest you may keep. Dear Aleppo, forgive me my uneaten rice, my litter, my abundance of light bulb. Forgive me my bed, soft and warm, even in January. Dear Baghdad, you still make me cry. Dear Doha, with you, I am always dreaming of starlit eels and honey water and birds bathing in fluorescent sky. I miss those colors. Dear Istanbul, marry me. Dear Dallas, I bought polished pebbles from your mall kiosks and pretended I was Aladdin, turning the soil over and gasping, Dear Gaza, I'm sorry.
But I don't want to end this with a discouraging message, even if that is how I often feel these days. I originally started this write-up because I thought my perspective as an Arab American could be valuable to others. It's been a strange existence these last 7 months or so. Conversations with my friends and family back home are full of pain, vulnerability, and attempts to uplift one another from feelings of shared powerlessness. Then I have to steel myself before walking into the office, where seemingly perfunctory conversations can suddenly turn galling. An egregious example was when a colleague of mine called saying he'd been thinking about me since October 7th, asking if my family in Palestine was all right. I thanked him for his concern and said that my family was safely in Lebanon. And he immediately replied, "Thank God for that. You know the other side has their suicide bombers lined up and ready to go." I was so taken aback that all I said in response was that violence only encourages more violence. To which he replied, "Yeah, let's hope they can take them all out before the terrorists get a chance to do anything horrible." So as you can tell, there's a night and day difference in these conversations, a contrast reflected in the media environment. Whereas my friends and family share insightful analyses on the evolution of Israeli political rhetoric or pertinent updates about Palestinian communities, here in the States, the coverage has been unflinchingly Zionist. The country's major mouthpieces, behemoths like CNN and the New York Times, have codified exceptions to their usual standards and practices when it comes to Israel, the former mandating that all reporting go through their Jerusalem Bureau for approval before publishing, the latter requesting its staff avoid certain words like genocide, ethnic cleansing, and even occupied territory. After bathing the news in this pro-Israel light, U.S. media then refracts it solely through the lens of the upcoming presidential election. In the words of President Biden's own campaign staff, Palestine is a, quote, messaging problem. As far as they're concerned, the worst damage Israeli bombs can do isn't in Gaza, but the ballot box. Worried at the prospect of losing the election, they've depicted the youth protesting at college campuses today and their allies on the left as Trump's useful idiots, or worse. Their message is essentially, "We're not sure if you're ignorant, overly sentimental, or just plain anti-Semitic, but you're killing democracy by not voting for Joe Biden." Unsurprisingly, this approach only compounds their messaging problem. And it's ironic that they don't see the fundamentally anti-democratic nature of this stance. To them, I say, if anything is poisoning American democracy, it's this country's relationship with Israel. Free speech is the cornerstone of any democracy, and Israel's most steadfast allies have all suffered a palpable decline on that front. Shocking examples abound, from the brutal treatment of peaceful protesters on American campuses to the silencing of ardent and intelligent voices speaking up for Palestine in Germany. Furthermore, Israel is predisposed to furthering diplomatic relationships with other nations when someone with autocratic tendencies is in charge. Bolsonaro, Milei, Modi, and of course, Trump, who recognized Jerusalem as the Israeli capital and moved the U.S. embassy to the city after generous donations by the billionaire Sheldon Adelson. Beyond the stifling of free speech and coziness with autocrats, Israeli money regularly pours into political races in the U.S. to ward away any candidates deemed hostile to the status quo. None of this is good for American democracy. Yet Israel is proudly hailed as a force for good across the entire political establishment. The horror of what's unfolding in Gaza has galvanized many people of conscience into action. While political bipartisanship pretty much defines the rhetoric used to discuss any such issue in US media, it is clear that the base of supporters calling for justice in Palestine goes beyond those narrow definitions. In these dark months, the allyship of entire communities that seem to resonate with the sense of oppression, people who really get it, has been a beautiful and heartening ray of light. Native Americans, Latinos, Black Americans, Muslim Americans, LGBTQ+ folks, and of course many white and Jewish Americans, whose support is quite literally invaluable. Being joined by this diverse coalition at rallies gave me a perspective I had never appreciated before. We were more than hyphenated American identities. We are, I am, American. A sense of belonging that had long eluded me. But it's not the personal significance of this allyship that I want to highlight. There's something more important here. There remains a disheartening amount of prejudice back home. And I don't just mean Lebanon, but the wider region as well. There are unaddressed biases against certain races and religions, and regressive attitudes towards women, gender, and sexuality. The groups most actively involved in combat against Israel seem to hold these views in abundance because they tend to be especially conservative. Hamas and Hezbollah both mix religious ideology with their politics and adopt the uncompromising rhetoric of devotees. It's worth taking a minute to investigate the structural reasons for this and consider the consequences. The antagonism against championing Palestine is so severe that only groups bound by such rigid worldviews can endure long enough to challenge Israel. Consider Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. In each of these three very different situations, it was the unrelenting hostility faced by a population which led to the social hardening that in turn gave rise to the inflexible ideologies they hold today. The Shah's tyrannical regime led his opponents to work hand in hand, bringing groups that otherwise would have never come together. Workers, students, communists, and others overcame their initial suspicions and embraced Khomeini's austere religious supporters. In Lebanon, there were all sorts of resistant movements against the Israelis following their invasion of the country, but the only one that survived was Hezbollah, which sustained itself through Iranian support and adopted a millennialist framework which superseded worldly considerations. Hamas was only created after long decades of dashed hopes and steady decline. It is not a genocidal group hell-bent on annihilating all the world's Jews. It's an accelerationist one that refuses to allow the Palestinian people to go gently into that good night. Instead of dying quietly, out of sight and out of mind, Hamas would prefer to fight back using any and all means necessary. While the Palestinian people have no say over which groups claim to support their cause, I am personally ambivalent about two of these allies. Violence against civilian populations should never be accepted. And although I cannot wholeheartedly object to any acts of indigenous resistance in Palestine, it is important to note that such acts do more harm to the cause for justice than good. Iran and Hezbollah both participated in the oppression of the Syrian people when they dared resist their tyrannical government. I will never see them as true freedom fighters again. Conversely, Hamas, who understands what oppression is, elected to withdraw entirely from Syria at the outbreak of its civil war. Out of the three, they're the ones with the least innocent blood on their hands. But I've been focused on the warriors, and the movement for justice will require something entirely different than a believer's zeal. In order for it to grow to fruition, it will need the support of all sympathetic communities, all oppressed peoples. It is a treasured dream, my hope beyond all hopes, that through liberating Palestine, we can also liberate ourselves from the prejudices with which we oppress one another. Or perhaps it is more apt to say that unless we liberate Palestine, we won't be able to liberate ourselves. I'm trying to wrap this up, and I really want to avoid suggesting solutions like some kind of armchair expert. Only the Palestinians can decide what justice looks like, by which I mean all three kinds of Palestinians: the Arab citizens of Israel, those living in the West Bank and surviving in Gaza, and those in the diaspora. Any solution that ignores one of them is inherently unjust and doomed to failure. The unflinching support Israel receives from its allies means that it has never had an incentive to pursue such negotiations, however. It routinely wards away the prospects of peace by arresting those who wield any popular legitimacy, depriving the Palestinian people of real representation. Israel is then free to decry the absence of a partner for peace. The hypocrisy is compounded by its wholesale denial of Palestinian history, an attitude pervasive in Israeli society. Palestinians are described as Arab invaders who taint the Jewish homeland with their presence. Until Israel comes to terms with the fact that Palestinians have a valid claim to the land, it will not be able to genuinely negotiate a lasting solution. All of the proposals put forth by Israeli governments over the years have been hollow because they fundamentally deny this reality. None of the two-state formulations divide the land to create two homes. By insisting on wielding a monopoly on military power and policing all borders, imports, and immigrants, these Israeli proposals are more akin to finding a convenient space to imprison the Palestinian population within. I can think of two ways to contribute to the cause of Palestinian liberation from afar. The first is to talk about it, or at least make sure the subject is no longer taboo in the West. What I told Andrew about my faith in the American system wasn't just some line I threw in to appease his sensibilities. I truly believe that the US position can be reformed through grassroots activism. To achieve that, we need to push back against the arbiters of free speech and to support those who bravely stand against them. My favorite charity is Palestine Legal, an organization which provides pro bono resources to anyone whose activism for a free Palestine is illegally suppressed or attacked. Please consider donating to them, or any group that wages the important war for our rights to free expression. The second bit of advice is to not look away. No matter how hard it seems, it is important, it is critical, that we witness the suffering of the Palestinians. When we're being constantly gaslit by reputable news sources, it becomes incumbent upon us to seek out the truth. While we work to limit the amount of death unleashed by Israel on Gaza, let us at least try and make sure nobody dies alone. That as few as possible of the countless dead go unnoticed. I would like to end with some poetry, an unexpected source of comfort and commiseration in these difficult times. The following two poems, a plea and a response, originally had nothing to do with Palestine. In 2015, a dying Tunisian poet wrote some verse, and another replied in kind. From his deathbed, Aulad Ahmed wrote, O medicine, O God, do not leave me with this wolf alone. For if you leave me in my solitude, I shall be desolate, utterly alone. The next day, his compatriot, Bahr al-Arfai's response came, Be sure that I love you, that I see the breath of the Creator within you, that I have prayed for you the way you have prayed for me. We, my brother, my companion, are on this road together like specks of eternal dust. Let us not abandon our brothers and sisters in Palestine in their hour of need. Let us never leave them with the wolf alone. Thank you for listening. From the river to the sea, Palestine and all its children, Muslims, Christians, Jews, everyone, will be free.
أيها الطب والرب لا تتركاني مع الذئب وحدي وإن شئتما فدعاني إلى وحدتي واحدا ووحيدا